Now, on the basis of, to get back where we left off, on the basis of this kind of an analysis of the words in that phrase, the place which the Lord your God shall choose in one of your tribes, Howard concludes that the question is not one or more, but rather it's whether the place is selected by arbitrary human means or whether it's by divine choice. In other words, what he does is put stress on the verb bahar. It's in the place which the Lord shall choose. It's not, the issue is not so much whether there's one or more of those places, but that it is a place of the Lord's choice. It's not just arbitrary choice. There are a couple other factors that that Howard appeals to support his position. He says, if Deuteronomy 12 says that all the offerings are to be brought at one place only, think of what that meant practically speaking for people who live, for example, in Dan, way in the north. It's about 90 miles from Jerusalem. That would be like a family now making a trip to Florida or something from Philadelphia in order to offer a sacrifice. You're going to walk that. It's going to take you a while. He says it'd mean an absence of at least a week. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Since the place where the Lord your God chooses to set his name
is so far,
away from you when the Lord your God blesses you. And then it says, well, I had an exchange that's offering into money and then bring that monetary sum because it's more feasible to carry to the offering and then the exchange is
All right, let me come back to that. If you'll hold that for a minute.
Yeah.
I will come back to it. Because what I want to do is finish what Hallward is arguing. Then I want to go back and look closer at the whole flow of thought in Deuteronomy 12. Then I want to suggest on the basis of a more recent study, a modification to Hallward's view that's going to apply to that. It's too far ahead. But just think about the practical implications of that. There were a lot of occasions on which an Israelite was supposed to bring a sacrifice. Would he have to go to Jerusalem every time? What would it mean for the Levites? They were to accompany these people to the place of sacrifice. They'd be on the road all the time. They might as well just stay in Jerusalem. Is making a trip back and forth to distant points. So it doesn't seem that if Deuteronomy 12 requires only one central altar, one altar, one legitimate place of sacrifice, it doesn't seem that it's a very practical thing. It could never really have been carried out.
Well, I guess for me, in addition to the idea of one place of I'm wondering about the mechanism for choosing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that's the kind of thing that you expect there would be just one place.
Well, unless that mechanism is, the place where the temple was chosen was on that threshing floor of Aruna, where there seemed to be some indication that here was a place that God would set apart. But you could say the altar at Bethel, where God appeared to Jacob. Here was a manifestation of God that gives the legitimacy or sanction. His name appeared there to building an altar there. And there undoubtedly were other places. maybe some of them recorded, some of them not recorded, where the Lord would have appeared, that would have given a legitimate right to building an altar, which is then not just building an altar anywhere you feel like, but a place where there was some divine sanction in some way, admittedly somewhat vague exactly how that would work. Hold that, and let's go a bit further. Holwerder's conclusion is that Israel did not have a law that bound the cult to one place alone. But Israel lived under a law that provided for local altars next to a central sanctuary. Central sanctuary, not in the sense of soul sanctuary, but primacy of place, you might say, would be given to the altar in the temple, or previously to the altar in the tabernacle, but not to the exclusion of legitimate altars elsewhere. So that what was regulated was the place where the altar was to be built. The Lord would designate that in some way. The place where the altar was to be built, the material out of which it was to be built, and then, of course, the offerings which were to be brought. What offerings were to be brought and how they were to be brought, that was all regulated in the Pentateuchal legislation. So arbitrariness and human contrivance are excluded in each of those areas or matters. The place, the material, and the kinds of offerings. In the place and the materials and the kinds of offerings is all regulated. And the Lord spelled that out. But God provided many altars to keep his people from temptation. Canaanites had altars everywhere. If the Israelites were living in the middle of the Canaanites and they had their altars and Israel didn't, that could easily lead them into temptation. But to keep them from that, to keep them in fellowship with himself, he provided a place for offering that would be accessible. So that's generally Holwerder's position. What I'd like to do now is go back to Deuteronomy 12 and look at the chapter instead of just at that one phrase. Let's go down through the chapter and see how it closed. And I'll just make a few comments on it, pretty much again following Holwerder's exegesis. If you have a Hebrew text, you might want to look at it. Verse 12:1 reads, "These are the statutes and ordinances which ye shall observe to do in the land which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess all the days that ye live on the earth." These are the statutes and ordinances. If you look at the text, you see, Ela ha-hukim ha-mishpatim, the statutes and the ordinances. Holwerder takes those terms as basically synonymous, the hukim and the ha-mishpatim. He says those who try to distinguish between them say either that the hukim refers to principles and the mishpatim to specific regulations, or the hukim is religious cultic requirements and the mishpatim civil and criminal requirements, and he feels the distinction is hard to maintain. So he takes them as basically synonymous. He points back to chapter 6, verse 1, where interestingly enough, HaMitzvah is prefixed to those two terms. 6:1, now I'm reading from King James, which really is not a literal translation. The King James says, "Now these are the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances." King James has plural there. If you look at the Hebrew text, it's a singular. Now, this is the commandment, statutes, and ordinances. HaMitzvah. And Holwerder takes the mitzvah as the fundamental requirement or basic commandment, namely that of the first commandment. Have no other gods. That's the basic commandment. And then you have that mitzvah, no other gods, the basic commandment. Then you have the Hukim and the Mishpatim as further outworking of the basic commandment. So that he feels chapters 6 to 11 concern mostly the mitzvah, the commandment. Loyalty to the Lord alone. And that's been dealt with in 6 through 11. And now, at 12:1, you begin consideration of Hukim Mishpatim. The further outworking of that into more detailed regulations. Now, interestingly enough, 12 begins with consideration of the cult. And it's that that's the second commandment is concerned with. Thou shalt not bow down to them or serve them. Thou shalt not make any graven image, so forth. So 12:2 then says, ye shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess serve their gods upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree. You shall utterly destroy all these places where the Canaanites serve their gods. They're to be destroyed. Verse 3 says, and you shall overthrow their altars, break down their pillars, burn their idols with fire. You shall hew down the carved images of their gods, destroy the names of them out of that place. And then verse 4 says, ye shall not do so unto the Lord your God. You look at the Hebrew text. Lo ta'asun kain. Not you shall do kain, so or thus. So what does the so or thus refer? It must be to the worship of the Lord in the manner of the Canaanite idols. And at the heathen places of worship, at the heathen sanctuaries. You're not to do so to the Lord your God. If Israel takes over the heathen places of worship, then that sharp antithesis between the worship of the Lord and the worship of these heathen deities is erased. So, the basic idea, Hallward reveals, of chapter 6 to 11, which is serve the Lord only, is expressed here in verses 4 and 5, worked out in the area of the second command. So that the basic assumption with respect to the places of worship, which you find in Wellhausen and his followers, is fundamentally wrong. Because what's Wellhausen say? Wellhausen says Israel took over the Canaanite high places. Remember, Israelite worship developed out of Canaanite heathenism, and they just took over the Canaanite high places, and that only later, under prophetic influence, did you have opposition to that. And what this is saying is quite contrary to that. When you come into the land of Canaan, you're to wipe out all those things, and you're only to worship in the place which I will choose. Now, of course, it's true that Israel didn't always take that command seriously. The command was there, and that's what they were to do. They didn't always follow it. So you find early in the book of Judges, they were worshiping at the heathen high places, and they were condemned for that. Judges 2, 1 to 5. But that's quite different than Wellhausen's thesis. So verse 5, but to the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes, put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and there thou shalt come. In sharp contrast with verse 4, see, 5 starts in the Hebrew with ki'im, but unto thee place. And that's very similar expression than to the one we looked at in verse 14. We'll come back to that later. But that's in contrast to the heathen places. To the place that the Lord shall choose, that's where you're to go. Verse 6, and there shall you bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes, your heave offerings, your hand, your vows, your free will offerings, your firstlings of your herds and your flocks. So the offerings are to be brought in the place specified in verse 5. And you have these categories of offerings mentioned that are to be brought to that place. Then verse 7 says, there shall ye eat before the Lord your God. Ye shall rejoice in all that ye put your hand unto, you and all your households, wherein the Lord thy God hath blessed thee. The offerings of verse 6 are to be eaten at the place of verse 5. It all flows together. The offerings of verse 6 are to be eaten at the place that's mentioned in verse 5. And that's to be done before the Lord. You shall eat before the Lord. The Lord is present in that place in some sense. And there ye shall rejoice. The Israelite sacrifices were different in concept than the Canaanite. In the Canaanite ritual, sacrifice had a magical character. You attempt by bringing the sacrifice to ensure fertility. In Israelite understanding, the fertility of the land is a gift from the Lord. Deuteronomy 8 says that. The cult or the sacrifice is not magical. They don't produce that. But the sacrifices are to be given as an expression of thanksgiving and rejoicing for what has already been received. So that they are told then, you eat before the Lord and you rejoice in all that you put your hand unto, ye and your household, wherein the Lord thy God hath blessed thee. Verse 8, my text is torn here. Let me look in the NIV. Verse 8 says, you are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. You are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. Now, that says, apparently, that when Israel enters Canaan, she's to change from present practice. You're not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. And it seems that that change has respect to the place of sacrifice. Now the question is, what situation does Moses have in mind that is to change? He characterizes the situation as one that's sort of unregulated. Everybody does what's right in his own eyes. Everyone does as he sees fit. Now some understand that as a reference to the wilderness period. And say that during the time of the wilderness wandering, that was the situation. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes during that entire wilderness period. Hallward rejects that. Hallward says I'm looking at the Hebrew form. If you look at 12:8 in the Hebrew text, Lo ta'asum kakol asher anachnu. Not you shall do according to all asher which anachnu we osim are doing po hayom, here today. The anachnu, the we. Forward it says the anachnu speaks of the presently living generation, what we are doing. The osim, we osim, are doing, indicates present continuing character of the practices referred to. Something's going on right in the time in which he's speaking. And the po here localizes it. It's not a reference to the wilderness time, but to the here and now. And Hayom even makes that more specific. Today, it says. So that what he says is, during the wilderness period, he feels it was possible to follow a regularly organized cultic practice. Why? Israel wasn't threatened by enemies. They wandered through the wilderness, just in a few exceptional cases were they threatened by enemies. But in the present situation, when they come into the land of Moab and into the Transjordan area, they'd entered into conditions of warfare. They fought Og, king of Bashan, and Sion, those eastern kings there. And you look at verse 10, and it says, But you will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you so that you will live in safety. Now, they weren't in rest. They were in this condition of disruption. So in that condition, there was deviation from the rule mentioned in Exodus 12:24. Exodus 12:24 said, you're to sacrifice only in the place where I come to you. And here, you see, you're not to do as we do here today. Everyone as he sees fit. Everyone doing as it's right in his own eyes. Sacrificing most anywhere. So he feels that the period of unrest began when Israel fought Sihon and Og in the conquest of Transjordan. And that was the reason for the present practice. The war situation so disrupted normal orderliness that it led to arbitrariness with respect to places of sacrifice. And the people were just sacrificing anywhere. Moses sort of excuses it because of the conditions. But what he's saying is, that's going to change. You come into the land. Then you don't do as you are doing here today, now, just sacrificing anywhere. You are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. Verse 9. Since you have not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance the Lord your God has given you. The excuse for the present situation is mentioned. They haven't yet reached that resting place. And of course here you get to that question we discussed earlier. When would they reach that resting place? Is it not till the time of David? I think it's better, as Hallward has suggested, view it in the time of Joshua, immediately after the conquest. Joshua 21:42, 22:4. And I think verse 10 confirms that. But you will cross the Jordan, settle in the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you so that you will live in safety. The rest begins when the conquest is finished. And then verse 11 says, then to the place, that time, the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. There you are to bring everything I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifice, your tithes, your special gifts, all the choice possessions you have vowed to the Lord. When the wars of conquest are finished, which have caused arbitrariness with respect to the place of sacrifice, then that command is to be taken seriously. You sacrifice only at the place the Lord your God will choose. Verse 12 pretty much corresponds with verse 7. And there rejoice before the Lord your God, your sons, your daughters, your menservants, maidservants, the Levites from your towns who have no allotment or inheritance of their own. Verse 13, be careful not to sacrifice your burnt offerings anywhere you please. The matter of place is again emphasized. And I think here you see a little more indication of what the arbitrariness of verse 8 was referring to. You're not to do, in verse 8, as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. Verse 13 indicates what that is. Be careful not to sacrifice your burnt offerings anywhere you please. Anywhere you see fit. What they were doing there was just using any altar they found in the unsettled conditions to bring offerings. And the altar law of Exodus 20 really wasn't being followed. And then verse 14 to conclude, offer them only at the place the Lord will choose in one of your tribes or in any of your tribes. And there observe everything I command you. In contrast to the present arbitrariness, Israel later must hold to the prescribed instructions concerning place of sacrifice. Now, if you go back to summarize, you have these phrases. That occur in the chapter. I've arranged them here in an order that starts with the simplest expression first. In 18 to 26, you get that expression, Bama kom asher yivhar Adonai Elohecha. That's the simplest form. You find it in 18 and 26. The one thing is said with emphasis in that phrase, the choice of the place is dependent on the Lord's choosing. In the place which the Lord your God shall choose. So over against arbitrariness in choice of place, it's the place that the Lord shall choose. When you go to verse 11, there's an additional element. There you get the place which the Lord your God shall choose. Bo l'shakein shemo sham. To place his name in it. To cause his name to dwell there. To cause his name to dwell there. So the idea of that expression, that added expression, is that there's a special relation between such a place, the place of sacrifice, and the Lord in his self-revelation. God makes that place of sacrifice a place of self-revelation. It's a place of manifestation of himself. Now some say the Lord's name can dwell in only one place. Holbert would contest that. There's no reason why the Lord could not place his name in more than one place. I want to come back to that later, but for the present, leave it with that. Verse 21, you get another additional element. You have the place which the Lord your God shall choose, la sum shemo sham. Excuse me. 11 and 21 are the same. It's in 14 you get the additional expression. Be'ahad shevateka sham, in one of your tribes. The place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes. Verse 21 is really the same as 11. We've already discussed that. It could be in any of your tribes, not necessarily in one of your tribes. And then the last expression, which is in verse 5, you have the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes to place his name there to dwell. There you sort of get all the phrases together. That's in verse 5. Now some have tried to link that with the expression in 1 Kings 8:16 with Jerusalem. You see, in 1 Kings 8:16, well, particularly verse 5, because 1 Kings 8:16 says, since the day that I brought forth my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city out of all the tribes of Israel to build a house that my name might be in it, but I chose David to be over my people Israel. I chose no city to place my name there to dwell. 1 Kings 8:16, and then numerous other references, like 11:32 of Kings. But ye shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake, for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. That out of all the tribes of Israel. Now what Holbert responds to that is that in all those texts, the term Hamakom does not occur. It's not the place, it's the city. And so he feels there's a distinction there. So that those texts don't speak of a place of sacrifice, but a specific geographic location, a city. So he feels this doesn't require centralization either. Now, we're quickly losing time here. That's basically Hallward's exegesis of Deuteronomy chapter 12. I think Hallward really did a service to the evangelical community to point out the significance of this issue, and then to suggest a way of reading Deuteronomy 12 that puts the biblical material, I think, in a much better perspective. However, there's been a more recent study, very detailed study. I put this on your bibliography. Again, it's a Dutch scholar, and it's not translated in English. But if you look at page... There's centralization here. Page 6, third entry, M.J. Paul. Het Archimedische Punt van de Pentateuch Kritiek. The Archimedean Point of Pentateuchal Criticism. 1988. That's this volume. And that is a book-length treatment of this whole centralization issue. It's just been published. He really feels he is pushing the approach of Hallward a step forward. And his conclusion about all this that I've just gone over with you is that he thinks it's possible to read Deuteronomy 12 that way, but he thinks it's a bit forced. And then what he does is make a distinction that after reading this book recently, I think I'm inclined to agree with. And I think his approach gives an improvement over Hallward's. He doesn't deny the possibility of Hallward's exegesis, but he concludes that the reading's too forced, and that what Deuteronomy 12 does is permit only one central sanctuary, but does not address the issue of multiplicity of altars. He feels Deuteronomy 12 permits one central sanctuary, but does not address the issue of multiplicity of altars. In other words, what he does, when he goes to 12, and you read, for example, verse 2 and 3, you shall utterly destroy the places. He understands place there, which is plural, but hamakim, he understands that as a reference to central sanctuaries of the Canaanites. And then he feels what flows in the chapter is a contrast. And the contrast is with Canaanite practices. You're to destroy their central sanctuaries, and then you are to bring your offerings to the central sanctuary that the Lord will choose in place of them. Hold your question just a second. He reads verses 8 and following, much as Hallward does, but relates the statements to the place of the central sanctuary rather than just the location of altars. So in the confused period of the time of the wars in Transjordan, where the cult couldn't operate according to normal rules, that central sanctuary was being put around in arbitrary places. That's the way he understands it. His conclusion is that chapter 12 addresses the issue of the central sanctuary, and most exegetes have read the chapter as a prohibition of all local altars. But he says that's not addressed at all. It's not talking about local altars. It speaks only of the central sanctuary. And he says that what Deuteronomy does, when you look at it as a book, he says there are two levels in view. On a national level, there's to be one central sanctuary. On the local level, many altars could be built. And he feels that the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 12 is addressing this. On the national level, there's to be one central sanctuary. Other places in the book of Deuteronomy, you get this addressed. For example, look at 16:21. This is a hard one for the Wellhausen school. 16:21 says, "Thou shalt not plant thee a grove of any trees near unto the altar of the Lord thy God, which thou shalt make thee." That doesn't seem to be talking about a central sanctuary. It seems to be talking about local altars. "Thou shalt not plant a grove of any trees near unto the altar of the Lord thy God, which thou shalt make thee." When you come into the land and you put up your altars, don't put trees near them like the Canaanites did. 27:5-6 in Deuteronomy. That's about Ebal and Gerizim. "There shalt thou build an altar to the Lord thy God, an altar of stones. Thou shalt not lift up any iron tool upon that." But there you have an altar in 27:5-6 at Ebal and Gerizim. That's not the central altar. And in 33:19, "They shall call the people unto the mountain. There shall they offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall suck the abundance of the seas and treasures hidden in the sand." That has to do with Zebulun and those tribes in the north, Issachar. And it speaks of offering sacrifices there in their territory. So he feels that the book addresses this at two different levels. The national level, there's one central sanctuary, that's Deuteronomy 12. The local level, there are many altars in some of these other passages in the book of Deuteronomy. Then what he says is that in Exodus, you have the same two levels. The national level, you get provision for the tabernacle. Exodus 25-27. That's where the instructions are given as to how the tabernacle is to be built. And then 36-40, it's actually set up. So on the national level, you get one central sanctuary, the tabernacle. On the local level, you have that altar law of Exodus 20:24-26. Of course, you get into Leviticus, you have the local level, all the prescriptions for their various kinds of sacrifices that are to be brought. So, he says when you understand that structure of both Exodus and Deuteronomy, he says what Wellhausen did was to compare two different levels of Exodus and Deuteronomy. In other words, let's put this out this way. Here's Exodus. And here's Deuteronomy. Exodus 25-27, 36-40. 24, 24-26. This is local, this is national. And what he's saying is, what Wellhausen did was do this. He's comparing B with A. Pardon? 20, 24, 26. What Wellhausen did, he's comparing B with A. He's taking two different levels, one level in Exodus and the other level in Deuteronomy, and comparing it. And he says it's understandable then that he sees a contradiction. And so what Wellhausen tried to do was to give these two things a different place in Israel's historical development. He's comparing apples with oranges. So the result was B was viewed as much older than A. And that's why he explained the difference. Now what Paul suggests in this recent volume is that both levels appear in both Exodus and in Deuteronomy, and it's incorrect then to compare regulations that deal with different aspects of the cult. What you need to do, if you're going to compare, compare the same thing. Compare this here and compare this here, and you find unity. No problem. But you see, that does involve a modification of Hallward's view about Deuteronomy 12. To understand the issue being addressed in the chapter, the issue of the central sanctuary, not the issue of multiplicity of altars. I think this is probably a better way to look at the chapter. Sorry about the time here. What about questions or discussion? About 3 minutes left.
Yeah.
Well, he feels that it's possible, but he feels it's too forced. I'm inclined to agree with him. I followed Hallward in this until I read this book a few weeks ago. I think Paul's exegesis fits better. See, he goes into a lot of things I haven't had time to discuss. The question that Katine brought up, I said I'd come back to that. The place at which I will cause my hand to dwell there. Paul discusses that phrase about the place where I will cause my hand to dwell. He feels that is consistently used with the central sanctuary.
Throughout
the references in the
book. That's why it's mentioned in various other books.
And that's the central sanctuary. Now, you could argue that. But you see, it's slightly different word. You could argue that the Exodus 20:24 says the same thing. It comes close to saying the same thing. But it's not the precise same wording. Exodus 20:24 says, in all the places where I record my name. In all the places where I record my name. It's very close. It's a similar idea. And I think what that's saying is there has to be some sort of divine designation of place for a local altar. But the place where I caused my name to dwell seems to refer either to the tabernacle or the temple, where the ark was, the central sanctuary. Now, he tries to work that out. He looks at a lot of references with that. But one you brought up, I've forgotten what it was now, but seemed to fit with that. Yeah, that one. Yeah, they'd be brought to the central sanctuary. But that's not saying that local altars are illegitimate. Yeah.
So in verse 8 of chapter 12, I'm not sure how.
Well, yeah, in verse 8 of chapter 12, he would say that has to do with the central sanctuary. In a time of war, it was being moved around, just being put anywhere. It's not talking about multiplicity of altars, just talking about that central sanctuary.
So they already have central sanctuary, the tabernacle.
The tabernacle, yeah. Okay.
How long did it take you to read that
book? Well, I don't know. I didn't keep track of that.
It's Dutch, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, that I can read Dutch about as fast as English, so that's not a problem. Yeah. I wanted to discuss the high places with you. You know, you raised that question about high places. There's just not time for that. I did make that comment on it. I think that the issue was increasingly it came to be felt that at these high places syncretism was taking place, and that's why these kings in the north particularly were wiping out the high places. It's not the issue of altars per se, it's what was going on at the altars. It's purification of worship, it's not centralization of worship. And I think that can be established. We had time to look at a lot of texts. Yeah.
In verse 8, when he talks about you're not supposed to keep doing what we are doing today.
Yeah.
That to me focuses on the purification of worship more than just the centralization. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. We need to worship according to the regulations that God has given. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Can you give a quick description of, let's say, somebody living on the coast? Let's say you're living there. When do you go to these local
altars?
Altars, and when do you go to the...
I'd say you go to the central sanctuary three times a year to the major festivals. Yeah, I can't quote the reference, but you know, it's in Deuteronomy, it's also in Exodus. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. It seems to me that on those occasions especially, there was a requirement to go to the central sanctuary. For other, you know, for a sin offering, a trespass offering, or whatever occasion might require an offering, paying a vow, you could go to the nearest local sanctuary. Normally, that's what would be the case. Not that you couldn't do that at the temple as well, but you didn't have to go to the temple to do it.
And the Levites, they were placed in every tribe. They didn't have a tribe allotment.
That's right. So they were scattered around. It seemed to me that they must have had some officiating capacity at a lot of these local altars, but then also accompanied the people when they went to Jerusalem at the time of the major festivals.
Now, are there evangelicals to say there were no local altars at all?
Yeah. There are evangelicals who have interpreted Deuteronomy 12 as saying there's one legitimate central sanctuary. They'll explain the Samuel passages as being, well, that's before the temple was built. Or before the rest that's spoken of in 2 Samuel 7, when David says, the Lord gave him rest. Well, then 12 goes into play subsequent to David. But you see, it's awfully hard to work that out because there are too many references that still don't fit that scheme.
What did they say about the Levites scattered? Why
do
they
spend
it?
I don't know.
Or what they do
after. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure.
In time of King, what's the relationship with altars at the high places?
The altars in the high places?
Yeah.
I think often altars were located on high hills. And it seems sometimes the Israelites took over heathen high places. That was illegitimate because they were explicitly told not to do that. But they could build an altar to the Lord on a high hill, like Samuel did say. He went up to the high place, and it seems to be a perfectly legitimate thing to offer a sacrifice to the Lord on a high hill. So that per se, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with the high place. It's only as the high places begin to introduce syncretistic or heathen worship that they become condemned. Let me just give you a couple of interesting references. In 1 Kings 15:14, speaking of Asa, you read, although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord all his life. Although he did not remove the high places. Now, look at 2 Chronicles 14:3. speaking of Asa, he removed the foreign altars and the high places and smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles. So King says he didn't remove the high places. Chronicle says he removed the foreign altars and the high places. It seems to me that in Kings you have a reference to the high places where the Lord was worshipped. Legitimate high places. Now, you say, what's the basis for that? Look at 2 Chronicles 33:17. 2 Chronicles 33:17. This is the time of Manasseh. But you read in 33:17, the people, however, continued to sacrifice at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. It seems to me, you see, you have to make distinctions between the kind of worship that was going on at high places. It wasn't always necessarily evil or wrong. And it seems to me that then when you read in Chronicles of Asa, he tore down the high places, and you read in Kings, he didn't tear down the high places, that maybe the way you explain that is he tore down the high places that were involved in heathen worship. He left the high places that were used in the worship of the Lord. I don't know. It's just a suggestion about that. But it seems to me that multiplicity of altars was not forbidden. And that the high place issue, even though it's a confusing one, has to do with whether the worship being carried on at the high place was worship of the Lord or whether it was syncretistic heathen worship. Yeah. All right, one more and we'll stop.
Can you summarize the difference between
Paul Werda? I think Paul Werda says Deuteronomy 12 is talking about multiplicity of altars. And what he's saying is the chapter is not to be read in a way that says there's only one legitimate altar. It can be the place the Lord chooses, any place in any of your tribes. There can be a number of altars, as long as they follow the regulations of being built according to the regulations of Exodus 24, and the location is not one of arbitrary choice, but one the Lord has indicated. There can be as many as follow those regulations. And what Paul says is, the chapter is not talking about multiplicity of altars. It's talking about the place of the central sanctuary. He says it doesn't even address the issue of multiplicity of altars. It's only talking about the national level, central sanctuary. And what it's saying is, when you come into the land of Canaan, the place where I cause my name to dwell, in one of your tribes, is going to be the place where that sanctuary is to be located. And so you can't compare then that material that's addressing the issue of the central sanctuary with the material out of Exodus that has to do with local situation and with places of sacrifice, legitimate places of sacrifice. You're comparing this level with this level and creating then the appearance of a conflict. Whereas both books address both situations. Exodus addresses the national situation with its material on the tabernacle, and of course Leviticus with some of its material on the Passover and various feasts and festivals, Day of Atonement. So that's national level. Local level is the altar level. So you have both levels and both books. And the appearance of conflict is done by not understanding it. Does that help? Okay, let's stop.